Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 8th of June. This hour, it's all things political, as it always is, Mondays at 9, and we have so much to talk about today. We'll continue to discuss Barack Obama's speech in Cairo, which many people are still analyzing, urging Middle East peace, and we'll talk about what happens next in that regard. His address and the gathering of dignitaries, World War II veterans who were part of D-Day 65 years ago. And we'll also be looking at health care. That's very much on the agenda as the president returns to the United States. As you heard during the news from National Public Radio, the president is also looking at delivering more than 600,000 jobs through his stimulus plan. How will that be achieved? And what about all that stimulus money? What's happened to it? We have a lot to discuss this hour. And our guest is Jim McCormick. Professor McCormick is professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Jim McCormick, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. It is amazing how fast everything is happening. These huge, meaningful speeches in Cairo, D-Day, back to the United States. It's a stimulus. It's health care. There almost isn't time to digest everything, is
it? Well, it's really a frenetic pace, isn't it, for any president, and particularly for this president, who really has taken on, you know, quite an agenda. He wants to solve a number of international problems as well as address a number of problems at home. So I admire his the frenetic pace that he has put forward and his energy in trying to address them.
Mm-hmm.
The crux of the matter is, of course, can he deliver on policy on these, and will the Congress and the American public support some of these initiatives?
Right. Let's spend a little bit of time on that remarkable Cairo address.
Right.
As he was speaking, the Times made reference to this yesterday. No matter how seriously and intelligently he presses Israel and the Palestinians to make peace, people were still fighting, and we've got all of these divisions within each society who have different ideas about what a solution can be. First of all, your statements on the speech, and secondly, what needs to happen at this point?
Well, I thought it was really a very good speech. What he set out at the beginning, of course, was that there was compatibility between Islam and the United States and trying to bridge any differences that have developed, or the gulf that really has developed there. And so I thought that was very good in recognizing the Islamic contribution to civilization at one juncture in the speech. I thought was quite notable as well. The other half of the speech, or maybe even two-thirds of the speech, was to talk about some issues that divide Islam, the Islamic world, the Muslim world in the United States, and really calling for bridging and addressing those issues. I mean, there were a list of some seven issues that he talked about, and some of them are quite controversial in the Islamic world. Women's rights, for example, democracy as another, religious freedom, you know, and talking about tolerance and so on. So I thought the way that he confronted these was really quite notable, and he did it in a very elegant kind of way without being sort of talking down in any fashion, but calling for both the United States and the Islamic world to address these issues.
You don't want to make too much of it, but there is something to be said for the fact that maybe only this guy, when you think of all the presidents we've had, his background fits being able to do what you just said without talking down to people because of his extraordinary background.
Well, he has, of course, grown up in the Islamic world in part. I mean, with his spending several years in Indonesia and going to grade school there. Of course, his father, also, he mentioned it in the speech, his father's heritage from Kenya, which has a large Islamic population as well. So he brings to that, but I think he also brings something else, and it's really evident even in a poll that I just saw that Gallup released this morning, the kind of personal style that he has, the personal attractiveness, his rhetorical skills here, I think also helps him, and that has been, you know, was evident in the Cairo speech as well as in, frankly, and we will get to it, is in the Normandy speech.
Mm-hmm. Does he take the wind out of Al-Qaeda, and if so, in what way, by delivering a speech like this?
Well, Well, I think what he does, of course, is the day that he arrived in Saudi Arabia, Osama bin Laden apparently released some sort of a tape here, and he really knocked that off the front pages, and in not only in the United States but around the world, and particularly in the Middle East. So I think that he does at least bring that, allows the United States to get a word in edgewise here with regard to al-Qaeda in the Islamic world. The problem, of course, is, and the risk, is that raising expectations and can he deliver on any kind of policy? Mm-hmm. Because he outlined quite an agenda, it seems to me, even in the speech. If you look at the very end of the speech in Cairo, he talked about all of these kind of economic development efforts that the United States was going to undertake. Some of them actually have already been initiated with the Muslim world and go back to 3 or 4 years ago, really after 9/11 and really the Bush administration. But he wants to accelerate those sorts of things. And can he deliver on those things? And, of course, most importantly, and sort of the centerpiece, the longest portion of the speech was about Israeli-Palestinian relations and what the United States, how it can help. It wasn't going to impose a solution, but how it can help bring about a solution. And that's really the crux of the matter. As we know from, lots of writing on this, the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian issue will go a long ways, more than any kind of speech, to resolving any kind of problems that the United States has with the Islamic world.
Right. And then he goes to Buchenwald and has this incredibly moving experience with Elie Wiesel, who gives such a heartfelt speech. And you've got his great uncle who helped to liberate that camp. That was you could cry at that one. And a lot of people did watching it. It was again, very moving.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's masterful in this, and I don't mean in any kind of theatric sense, but he's masterful, it seems to me, in sort of capturing the moment, and that's what we expect of our president. And that's why, in some ways it's a great contrast with Bush, because the Bush persona could not, it seems to me, elicit the same kind of response that Barack Obama has been able to do. Whether this is sustained or not, of course, is the question, but he has great skill, it seems to me, in touching the magic moment and providing the kind of what really was called for there, of course, was moral leadership. And I think his statement about the Holocaust and anybody that would deny it, it was kind of hateful kind of speech is what he said. And that, I think, was also a very poignant moment.
And directed certainly at Ahmadinejad, the elections in Iran are Friday. Would you like to comment on those? Do you think there's a chance he will be voted out?
Well, we were surprised in Lebanon this morning because I was expecting that Hezbollah would do much better than it did, which would further complicate the Middle East. I mean, in some ways, the administration is very fortunate in terms of the Lebanon elections. Whether they will be that fortunate or not with regard to Iran, I think, is problematic. I mean, the best that can be hoped for is Ahmadinejad would not be reelected, and there would be somebody a little bit more moderate. But that, I think, we ought to be awful careful about saying how much more moderate that will mean in terms of changing the direction of Iran at the moment.
It is hard to believe that any world leader can get away with making a statement denying the Holocaust, isn't it?
Well, it is remarkable and incredible, and I think that's what was not only mentioned in the Cairo speech by President Obama, but then, of course, accentuated by his visit to Germany.
Mm-hmm. And then the commemoration of D-Day, and there won't be too many markings of this day on the part of the participants because increasingly they're no longer with us.
Well, yeah, it was quite touching there too. As you may recall, that President Obama in his speech at Normandy made reference to one veteran who had made the journey there, but had died that Friday night in his sleep after having visited the cemetery. I think that was not the first visit for that veteran, but unfortunately, it proved to be his last visit.
And what did you think of the remarks that were said there in the gathering of these World War II vets? You think about obviously we have our own set of huge problems, but you think about the world and finding the Nazis and these men who died by the thousands in that particular
war. Well,
what
I thought was striking was the comment that these young men had, mustered enough courage to take this beach, knowing that the odds were very much against them.
Mm-hmm.
And President Obama, you know, made that point in his speech. And the other leaders that spoke there, I mean, I didn't see the complete remarks, but they made, likewise, Prime Minister Brown and Prime Minister Harper from Canada and President Sarkozy of France, you know, made similar speeches. But what also was touching was the recognition, and I guess I hadn't fully absorbed this, the number of American graves that are there, numbering over 9,000. I've not had the chance to go to the American cemetery in Normandy. I'd like to, obviously, but that was quite striking too. All of the lives that were lost there that day, or well, in the succeeding months, actually.
Right, the sea of blood, as so many of the vets describe the ocean.
Yes,
it's just sea of blood. And then he comes back, does a round of golf, and we got health care on the table in a big way this summer, I guess.
Well, I think you know. He has said that he is going to be much more involved in the debate. I read accounts that he's going to hold a series of town meetings and so on. And so he's going to thrust himself more into that debate and I suppose put himself on the line in terms of the outcome of that issue and see that as really a central issue of his administration, along with energy policy on the domestic front. And I guess we could add also the economy generally here.
Right. And I'm wondering if you think he has been front and center on the health care debate, or has he, because he's got so much else going on, let this get away from him some?
I think he has not, you know, stepped up initially on that. He's certainly made a speech or two on it. But, you know, he's really been much more high profile on foreign policy issues, it seems to me. I mean, with his trip to Europe earlier and to Latin America and now to the Middle East. I mean, those are the issues that he's really been highlighting here. And, you know, I think to be honest, with a relatively mixed record of success. I mean, he's made overtures to some of these countries, you know, in terms of whether it's Iran or even to the Europeans or to Latin America. And there's not always been the response from them. I mean, there's been a lot of reaching out, it seems to me, but I'm not sure how much reciprocation has really occurred yet.
Why is that?
Well, I think policy takes time, and I think that is one of the things that American people, you know, they're largely impatient in terms of policy, and just making a speech or making, and as Cairo was, is not going to sort of change the tide here of history. It means a lot of negotiation, a lot of hard work, a lot of trying to pull these parties back together. I mean, you talked earlier about the situation in the Middle East. You know, you got domestic kind of constraints. I mean, we think about why can't these problems be solved? But, you know, Netanyahu's got a kind of coalition in Israel that he's trying to hold together. And of course, part of that, a crucial part of that, is over the settlements, which was a big issue in the Cairo speech by President Obama. And you got in Islamic countries and trying to deal with their domestic populations and not make too many concessions or not being seen as making too many concessions to either the other side, in this case the Israelis, or even to be too responsive to the actions of the Americans here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, and this is what I emphasize a lot because I teach foreign policy here, is the domestic constraints on foreign policy are a lot more numerous than people like to accept.
Let's go back to health care for just a moment.
Sure.
Here. The reports over the weekend are that the president really wants, as a centerpiece of his plan, to have some kind of public health care plan in addition to private insurance. Those who are opposed to this are very worried that eventually we're just going to have a public plan and no private insurance and a decreased quality of health care. He hasn't really made that a centerpiece. He hasn't talked a whole lot about it. Do you think that is a centerpiece? And if so, what are the chances that he can get something like that passed? It would be a very big change in the health care system in this country.
I do think it is an important component of what he wants to put into place. He wants to have, I think, an admixture of public and private sector insurance. And that probably, in the American setting, is the best possible outcome that he could achieve. Because the efforts to try to eliminate, it seems to me, all private insurance will be met with a firestorm, it seems to me. Because, you know, again, there are horror stories about, just in Canada a week or 10 days ago, and, you know, you still have this problem where you have national health insurance, but you have people that have to wait in line. And, for example, just to make one point here, one person was trying to get an MRI, and she had to wait for 6 months before that could happen. That's pretty routine occurrence in the American health system. So I think the possibility of eliminating the private sector, which obviously stimulates more responsive medical personnel here to the needs of their patients, is remote. But I do think there has to be some sort of public option for those people that either are uninsured or uninsurable that would have some minimum kind of health care that they would have, particularly on the preventive side, it seems to me, if you had the public sector care available, you at least have the possibility of reducing costs by having some preventive actions by individuals.
It's been a long time coming, some change in healthcare, hasn't it? Not that it's happened yet either, but
no, it has not happened, and I think it'll. But I think the conditions are much better than occurred in 1993 when the Clinton administration tried to make. I mean, President Obama has got a Congress that Clinton had a Democratic Congress as well at that particular moment, but he's got a much larger majority here, and I think also. The country is ready for this, given the cost that Medicare is piling up, and those kind of, and there's really a realization of the expense that healthcare does incur for the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to phone calls, the two journalists who were sentenced to 12 years in prison in North Korea, I would think it would be incredibly difficult to negotiate with the North Koreans. What is this all about? Are they trying to have some important negotiating point for something they want? Why would they sentence them to 12 years in prison?
Well, it is remarkable. I noticed that the Obama administration said they wanted to handle this separately from the nuclear side. You know, they sort of de-link this kind of humanitarian issue from the political military issue that the nuclear explosion that the North Koreans had. I think it's really impossible to do, and certainly the North Koreans will not want to so-called de-link these issues. I mean, linkage politics and linking issues together is always the case. Well, that length of sentence is really quite remarkable. Might well be that they want to negotiate for food supplies, maybe oil supplies, or something like that. I mean, that has been one of the ways that, given the North Korean economy, that they might want to bargain away some of those that sentencing period.
Phone calls. We haven't even started with the economy yet, but we'll do that sometime during the next 35 minutes. All things political for this Monday, and our guest is Professor James McCormick. He is professor and chair at the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open and there's so much to talk about. It seems as though it was a while ago, but if you'd like to comment on President Obama's Cairo speech, the commemoration of D-Day over the weekend in Normandy, the speech at Buchenwald, healthcare reform in this country, the economy, the auto industry, the list goes on. Lines are open for you. We'll take your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program, Beamish and Madigan will join us. And I think that at least one of them does a bit of talking, but they are dogs, so they will have their trainer with them, Molly Johnson, who's the founder of Compassionate Canines, a volunteer-based group providing therapy dog teams, a connection to one another, and the opportunity to be a part of a more coordinated therapy dog volunteer effort in the Fox Valley. Oh, I can't wait for that hour. I've been looking forward to it for a long time. All right, let's go to phone calls for our guest, and we start with Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Am I on?
Yes, you are. Go ahead.
Okay, just two quick comments. First, with regards to the Cairo speech, yeah, I thought it was a very good speech, but the problem is that, you know, they're pressuring the Israelis to talk with the Palestinians, but the problem there is that there's so much infighting between Hamas and Fatah that there's nobody to talk to. So, you know, he can give all the speeches he wants, but until they, you know, reach some kind of an understanding of what they're going to do and who's going to be in power, and, you know, that's going to go on forever. Who do the Israelis talk to? That's one point. And the other is with regards to health care. You know, I think they're going about it incorrectly because they're going out and saying, you know, reform health care. And, you know, to the average American, man, that sounds socialist. But if the focus was, look, there are 40 million Americans who do not have health care. Let's all make a contribution so that they do have health care. That's very American. And probably most people would get on board with an idea like that, you know, by saying, we're not going to affect your health care, but we have to help these other people who don't have it. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Jim?
Yeah, I think who do the Israelis talk to? Well, there's a little bit of background on this, it seems to me. I mean, the caller is correct. Hamas has, you know, is taking over in Gaza, and there is the question of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and there is this issue that the Israelis will not talk or do not want to talk to Hamas. And in fact, the Americans have put down a marker in terms of the roadmap going back to 2002, roadmap to peace there, that Hamas must end its violence just as the Israelis must give up their settlements in the West Bank. And so they're really at a stalemate here. And I think what the president said in his speech was that both sides will obviously have to make some very hard decisions, as the way he put it here. And that does mean that Hamas and Fatah, you know, must come to some accommodation here, and one of the things must be that Hamas must give up violence, just as the Israelis must give up the settlements in the West Bank. Neither of those is easy because of the considerable suspicion and, you know, and even more so, hatred between the parties here. So I think the caller is absolutely on mark that before these kind of talks can take place, there's got to be compromises and concessions by both sides, and that has not been done. And that's what I was saying earlier about the speech, and then the policy implementation it can be a considerable distance here. He makes a good point about health care too, it seems to me. Reform health care. We have talked about the, you know, it was, as I can remember, in the political campaigns of candidate Clinton at the time, talking about 36 million people. Then it was 40, and then it was 47 million people that are uninsured. I think if it's done in the way that we have to, and for example, here in Iowa, and I think in Wisconsin as well, you know, the state has passed, particularly for children and youth health care options that are very, very minimal in terms of costs here. And again, as a way to start to get coverage of some of the most vulnerable populations. And I think maybe that's the way it will be portrayed and sold to the public.
Mm-hmm. And back to the Mideast for a moment. It's not only we were looking at the Palestinians. The reports over the weekend, Israeli radio reporting, settler extremists had sent letters to an Israeli general threatening him and his children and comparing the forces that remove settler outposts with the Jewish councils obliged to collaborate with the Nazis. So you got problems on that side too, right?
Well, this is what I was saying about kind of the domestic constraints here. Not only does Netanyahu try to hold his governing coalition together because he has some right-wing parties in it and some religious parties in his coalition, but you have this kind of action here, you know, sort of on the ground with the Israeli settlers, as well as trying to deal with Hamas and firing rockets into southern Israel.
Thanks very much, Mike, for the call. Let us go next to Shyla from Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. Hi. I wanted to comment on the two journalists being held in North Korea. And my comment on that is that when it's horrific for their family, they went there knowingly, took the risk to venture so close to the border. The government cannot and should not intervene on their behalf, because anything that the government does or concedes will be like paying ransom to them being held as hostages.
Well, I think these are both. Maybe correct me on this, or if I'm wrong on this. I think they're both American citizens. Is that right?
I believe they are.
Yeah,
yes.
And I think one of the first, you know, demands of any leadership is to try to look after their citizens, even when they are abroad. Now, I was really speculating. I don't have any firm knowledge that there is kind of any kind of you know, quid pro quo here in terms of for the release of these people in terms of whether it's humanitarian goods or services or what have you. I mean, but that is one of the ways diplomatically that countries save face and also, you know, get these kind of exchanges here. We've seen also more recently in Iran where the journalist from North Dakota was held, and, you know, obviously the government intervened. I do not know of any direct quid pro quo that they had, but they certainly tried to act as a petitioner in terms of getting the release of this journalist. And I would not I would be surprised if the U.S. government, even though it doesn't have direct relations with North Korea, did not try to make overtures to try to get the release of these journalists.
Thank you, Shiloh, for your call. Harold is next from Butler. Hi, Harold.
Hi, good morning. I would just like to make a comment about health care, and I heard it again here on your show and your first caller. The issue isn't socialized medicine, and this is the buzzwords that continually used. You know, every month for the last how many months, we have 655,000 human beings laid off from their jobs, and every one of those people that gets laid off from their job loses health care. It's not just the 47 million, this number that likes to be bantied about, 47 million. Every month there's 650,000 more people that are sent out on the street without health care. And sure, they get COBRA, but how would you like to be without a job and now have to pay $1,000 a month for your health care when you have no income? So, I mean, the flippant socialism business that I keep hearing these people who are against a national health care plan, it's a ridiculous argument, and it's getting to be sickening. And you know what? These people have to just stop. This isn't socialized medicine. People in this country need to be taken care of, and it's not just 47 million. Every month, there's 600,000 more people that need health care, not just the 47 million. And stop with the socialism, people. It's not socialized medicine. Thank you.
Thanks, Harold, for the call.
Well, do you want me to comment on that as
sure,
well?
Sure, sure. You get to comment on everything.
I think you make the point about COBRA, and even if you have, if you get laid off and you have COBRA opportunities, the cost per month, it can be quite substantial. There's no doubt. I hope we don't have every month 600 more thousand people. I mean, the idea, and maybe we're going to get to talk about the economy here.
Sure.
Is to not have so many people laid off, and not have to go to this kind of COBRA option here. The nice thing about the COBRA option, if people can afford it, obviously, is that they still have some insurance available for, I think it's 18 months or whatever. I think it's 18 months under COBRA.
Mm-hmm. So let's move to the economy for a moment. The president said some months ago that an indication that the economy was turning around and a goal of his was to hire millions of people, as many as jobs as had been lost last year, and then some within this year. Indications are that not a lot of stimulus money is being spent here. There are some projects underway. We do have word this morning that he's going to deliver 600,000 jobs for this summer. What's going on with the stimulus money? Why isn't more of it being spent right now?
Well, part of it is just the startup time on some of these projects here. The weather is one of, you know, in terms of particularly on roads and bridges and that sort of thing, building refitting. Just chatting with somebody yesterday, you know, they've got some stimulus money here in Iowa for energy activities, and all of that takes a little bit of time in terms of, you know, getting contracts out, getting the buildings that will be supported by this retrofitting or what have you. And so I think part of that is just kind of the startup time, if you will. And that's why, you know, I think it's a little bit heroic to suggest that, you know, by the end of the year, the economy is really going to turn around. I think we're really talking about into 2010 before we get this money really circulating in the economy itself. I just think that part of it is the startup time here.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any indications we have this kind of amorphous talk about, well, we're seeing some signs of recovery, but nothing is real specific? Do you see any specific signs that the economy is picking up again, Jim?
Well, not when you have a 9.4 unemployment figure that comes out last Friday.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it very hard to, you know, to say with much confidence that the economy is turning around. I mean, the best portrait that could be put on that 9.4% national figure, and I don't know what it is in Wisconsin, it's a little bit lower here in Iowa than that number, was that the number of unemployment applications, unemployment insurance applications, has started to level off and steady, which might mean an indication that, you know, that fewer people have been, you know, immediately put out of work, and so the future projections of unemployment might not continue to reach you know, double digits here. But all the projections that I've seen is that we're still in line for, you know, maybe reaching, you know, that double-digit figure within the next month or two here.
Mm-hmm. That's a large number of people unemployed, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it, you know, it's devastating to families and communities as well. Even with unemployment insurance, and, of course, as one of the previous caller there talked about in terms of health care and what that does with unemployment. And even if you have some unemployment insurance and have COBRA affiliated with your job, and some of these jobs don't have COBRA affiliated with it, the cost is quite substantial.
Mm-hmm. And you have all of these young people who are just graduating from college, who have a terrible job market, finding it hard to get jobs, high school students who usually get jobs, in college students who are in school still looking for summer employment, and it's really hard this year.
Well, it is very difficult. You know, some of the students here, for example, have gone back to summer school because they can't find employment. I mean, it's kind of ironic. I mean, we benefit in some ways when the economy has a little bit of a downturn here because there's more people, and I'm sure that's through in some of the Wisconsin schools as well, is that they go back to school partly to get more training, but partly because they cannot, you know, find some summer employment here. And, you know, this gets worse. Then you have the students competing with, you know, heads of households and so on, or supporters of households that are also looking for even temporary employment to kind of patch over the situation that they're in.
Right. We have lines open if you'd like to join our All Things Political conversation for this Monday, the 8th of June. Our guest is James McCormick, professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University in Ames, 800-486-8655. We also have an email address if you're at a computer and you can't get to a phone. Feel free to use that, and that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, Compassionate Canines, volunteer therapy dog teams providing comfort, support, and animal companionship to people of all ages, visiting hospitals and visiting schools and, well, all kinds of different settings. Hospice programs will be meeting the participants, the canine participants, and also Molly Johnson, who's the founder and a dog lover. She founded Compassionate Canines this year, actually. 800-486-8655, our number for Professor McCormick. And let's go to another caller. Gary is next from Kokana. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good morning. I just want to comment on one of the callers that a few minutes ago who went on a little bit of a rant about stop calling it socialized medicine, where in his very plea, he defined socialized medicine, and that's what he wants, when he said, these people just need to be taken care of. That's what socialized medicine is. Now, people do need a helping hand in this economy, but they don't need to be taken care of. They need to be lifted up a little bit. So, you know, you can call it what you want, but if you just say they need to be taken care of, where does it stop? Where does that taken care of stop? And I think I'm supportive of what Obama wants to do, but working in healthcare, I see the incredible, the apathy of people who are already getting federal assistance, that they don't care, they're not providing, helping themselves in any way. They take the healthcare system for granted. They're the ones that are overutilizing the healthcare system as it is right now, and we're just going to be overburdened. So that's my comment, and I'll listen to yours off the air.
All right, Gary.
Well, thank you very much. That I think a good comment there. I think the best thing, you know, in terms of people trying to meet their healthcare needs, and this has sometimes been a failing, is that some employers have not provided, or certainly have not provided, adequate health insurance. And if an individual can be seen to have health care opportunities from his employer or her employer, even if he or she has to share some of the burden in terms of the cost, I think they will be, as the caller suggests, more prudent in the kind of use it when they need it, but not overuse it or not abuse it here. I do think, though, and I guess I would make the point that you still need some baseline for those people that are either unemployed or unemployable, and for children that need health, some kind of health coverage, you probably need a system of support at the national level.
We go next to Pat from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a point about the Cairo speech and the fact that I think that rather than speaking in a negative manner about what the United States' chances might be of helping to find peace in the Middle East or the Palestinian-Israeli situation, that we need to applaud the efforts to try. Because even Barack Obama said, you know, this is a starting point. One speech is not going to do it. We've waited for 60 years for peace in this area or beyond. And if we wait, would the chances be we'll be waiting for another 60 years? And to say, well, we're not altogether sure who we're addressing, maybe some of the hesitance on the international community to immediately get on board with some of our peace overtures is because what if we have another George Bush in 4 years or 8 years? Are we going to be back to ground zero? So maybe the international community is saying, you know, let's wait and see what the long-term chances of the United States not reverting back to an aggressive foreign policy is. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Pat.
Well, again, I think the president made a good point afterwards when he was in Germany. He announced that George Mitchell, his envoy to the Middle East, who actually happened to also be the special envoy of President Bush to the Middle East, would be back in the region this week to try to jumpstart the conversations among these people in the various countries here, and try to get them to really operate on what the president had said in his Cairo speech here. I think ultimately, and it really goes back to earlier models, you're probably ultimately going to have some international conference where you bring all the parties in one room, or at least at one venue here, so that there is not this kind of moving from one capital to the other. But it would be premature to do that at this juncture. I mean, I was reading just recently a book about after the first Gulf War back in 1991, and which the first President Bush did call an international conference and tried to get movement on it, and was able to get all the parties to attend, which was an important breakthrough, but ultimately not a breakthrough for peace. But I think the caller is right that what you have to do is you have to make certain that there is continuing momentum, and we certainly lost that on the. There was this roadmap that was announced in 2002, but it really expired. It was supposed to be completed by 2005, and it really expired because of the Iraq War, but also other kind of intervening events here. And so I think there has to be momentum after the Cairo speech in terms of this policy implementation.
Mm-hmm. That George Mitchell gets around. He must be
he does.
Pretty good at his
he's
job,
been a federal
right?
judge. He's been a U.S. senator. He's been envoy. He's been heading commissions and so on. And he must be pretty exhausted by now.
Yeah, I would think so. James from Madison. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Doing well. Well, and I guess it leads into my next question. I am a recent grad at Madison, and I have to admit, going along with the previous discussions, it is pretty scary at this point. And I've noticed that a lot of my, and if I could poke fun at the socialism discussions, my comrades, my fellow recent graduates, they themselves have thought, oh, this is pretty scary, I kind of want out. They're looking for a way to kind of avoid the economic decisions that you need to make when you're looking for a job and maybe not finding one. So instead of looking for a job, they're thinking grad school. And I've noticed that this is kind of a common theme, not only, you know, among my friends, but in a larger network of undergraduates thinking the best way to escape the economic decision, the economic crisis right now, is to go to grad school. And I don't know what kind of, I have to admit, I don't know too much about the economy or economics. So my question is, what kind of effect would that have? This sort of huge influx of students then just skipping the crisis and going into a grad school, kind of delaying the crisis, if you will.
Well, it would be good for us in terms of enrollment and so on. Although it would, in some ironically, it would put pressure on us because universities are also having to face cutbacks in terms of faculty size and services and so on. I think there's another option here, and as the caller was talking, it struck me here. One of the things that some of the recent graduates might undertake, although it doesn't immediately lead to their kind of career options, is to think about working in the nonprofit or service sector here for a year or two, kind of in service to America. This has been a theme going back to several administrations, certainly one that President Obama would endorse as well, and providing sort of a sense of public service. Nothing wrong with graduate school. I would encourage that, furthering your education to get yourself even better prepared for facing the kind of economic conditions that might eventuate. But it seems to me that public service has the benefit of not only some on-the-job training, but also providing a real public good that would actually help the economy and help the society in this situation that we're at the moment.
What are your plans, James? What are you graduating in? Did you graduate in?
I'm graduating in a double major, communication arts, which doesn't get me very far, and East Asian studies, which I'm finding also doesn't get me very far.
Communication arts should. I mean, there's a lot of public radio talk shows here.
Yeah, a lot of jobs in that field. Yeah, a lot of jobs. You should go over to Vilas Hall and see if you can get an internship at some point, James.
Yeah, well, you know, as long as it pays, I guess.
Right. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Thank you. Best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye. That's a hard field these days, too, because newspapers are downsizing. Oh, right.
Downsizing, going to some newspapers 3 days a week publication or something. Detroit Free Press, I think, was one that I heard of, and maybe others going out of business, of course, even more so the Denver paper, Rocky Mountain News, or what have you.
Mm-hmm. So. The whole field is in transition. You have no idea where it's going. James, thanks very much for the call. John from Richland Center. Hi.
Hi. Very, very good morning. I've got a number of comments, and I'm coming this from the position of a doctor who practiced medicine for 40 years, was one of Madison's 100 best doctors for several years running. So I think I know about delivery of medical care. So first of all, I'd like to point out to all those people who want good medical care, there's an article in the Annals of Internal Medicine that came out this month, which says the demise of primary care, a diatribe from the trenches. So when you talk about all the kind of medical care, you got to read and see what it's like to be a primary care physician in this new system. That's number one. Number two, when I was on vacation, I spent many sauna hours with an economist from Toronto, and he says, well, for God's sakes, don't get into socialized medicine. It'll bankrupt your country. It's bankrupting Canada right now, but nobody dares to vote against it, so that'll always be there. It's bankrupting. Number three, I think everybody talks about socialized medicine or total care as a situation where you're going to have preventable medicine. I think the last caller, when you were talking about the fact that we should have some national programs or internships or something like Obama wants. If we would put emphasis on the food stamps, when you go to Walmart, it's just a sin to see all these fat people, these fat kids there, and we think that preventive medicine is going to change that. That is that we're bankrupting our whole economy down the road to take care of these people. Maybe we should be, instead of trying to control our medical expenses, control our food expenses and what's going down the mouths of all these people. Go through the line and see what these people are buying. That's where we really need help. We need more help in how we feed people than we give medical care. Now, the last thing I want to bring out is this. When we talk about, this is very political. When you talk about 50 million people that are uninsured, there's probably a large percentage who either do not want insurance or are in this country illegally. Okay, so if you take 50 million people, let's say maybe there's only 30 million. If you do the math, and this is one thing that my liberal friends never do, is they come from the School of Social Work, and they really are not in the business of math. We discussed that the other day on public radio, is that we're dealing with about 10% of the population. People are willing to put this country in total hock, our children and our grandchildren, $2 trillion to have this beautiful program. And the bottom line is that's only 10% of the population. 10% of the population does not make a health care crisis. We need to modify it. Badger care, we need to help people through like the other. But the other person who went on the diatribe about we've got to take care of people, socialize people, we got to do that too. But remember, when you give a guy his health insurance, you've taken all away his total motivation to get up in the morning and go for a job. We have got too many people who have no work ethic, who are just waiting their handouts, and this does not make forever a healthy economy. And I'll those are my comments, and Professor McCormick, I like the way you're doing things. Stay on and tell us about some of my comments.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
You've had more experience on the medical side, certainly, than I've had none, except visiting physicians occasionally here. I mean, I take your comment about I recently had a physical with my doctor, and he said, I asked him kind of poignantly, I said, do I need to lose some weight? He said, you know, every American needs to lose about 10 pounds. And, you know, I think that sort of summarizes what you're saying here, but maybe more than 10 pounds for some people here. But certainly I take to heart your point about that we also need not just a program of medicine, but I also need some self-discipline, I guess, in terms of our health care as well. The 30 million number, interesting kind of analysis. I guess I hadn't really thought of it in quite that way. But still, I don't want to get lost here that there are still 30 million people without coverage. And there also, I mean, we do have, even if there are some illegal immigrants, I think we still have an obligation, and maybe you won't agree with this, we still have some obligation in terms of health care to those folks as well. I mean, this is part of what I think, you know, consistent with American values here.
Let's go next to, we probably have time for one more call.
Okay.
Jerry from Madison. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Just a brief word in regards to socialized medicine. Socialized medicine would be where the government owns the hospitals and the clinics, and they directly employ the doctors and the nurses and all of the healthcare providers. And I would like to add that we already have that socialized medicine in our country in the form of the U.S. military and, you know, Army hospitals, Navy hospitals, et cetera. And I haven't heard any horror stories stemming from that. So I don't know what the big fear is.
All right, Jim.
Well, I think part of the problem with having a national system is we still have a shortage of nurses at the moment and healthcare providers more generally here. And I think that's part of the sort of the other side of the problem. The military Again, I don't know with detail about the military, but I suspect that they don't quite have that same sort of problem immediately here.
Mm-hmm. And thanks very much for the call. Well, we covered a lot of territory ourselves this hour, Jim.
We sure have.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Sure.
Enjoyed the hour.
Pleasure.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah.
Our guest this hour, Professor James McCormick. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. And just a reminder that we don't often schedule a certain topic. Well, we don't have one topic on all things political, but every Monday at 9, we take a look at what's been happening politically, international news, national news, what the president is up to, and a lot of the news comes from just the past 3 days. So we always do that Mondays at 9, in case you love these conversations. This is when they happen. So thank you to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to Rob Schroeder for doing our on-air production in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your calls. Dog lovers, please stay tuned. This is the Ideas Network.